Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
This is Writers on Film, the only podcast dedicated to books on cinema.
Hello everybody and welcome to Writers on Film. My name is John Bleasdale. I'm a writer and film critic, and today I'm going to be talking to Charles Bromesco, who has written a wonderful book. It's his second book. First book was about vampire movies. Charles has written for Rolling Stone, The Guardian, and a slew of other publications, but his new book is about colours and cinema. It's a wonderful, attractive book. It's perfect for it's perfect as a book to dip into, but you can, as I did, read it cover to cover equally, and it looks marvelous, and it's fantastic. So if you enjoy the episode, please remember to subscribe, to like, to follow me on Twitter at Dr. Jonty, DRJONTY. But before you do any of that, please enjoy the conversation. What an original concept. What a fascinating. Yeah, it was really, because one of the things I was thinking about when I was reading it is that, I mean, I read quite a lot of, well, I'm obviously reading lots of film books all the time because of this podcast, but the idea of like a coffee table book is often used like as a denigrating thing, as a sort of like, oh, it's a, but this is like a concept which is perfectly marries that idea of something that you're going to pore over and sort of physically enjoy, as well as being a sort of fascinating take on cinema. How did you come up with the idea?
So actually the publishers approached me with this idea. They reached out thinking, you know, the very basic concept of a book about color and film arranged in this structure of 50 palettes. And so it was sort of, you know, the early gestative seed of an idea that I kind of tried to take and run with as far as I could. You know, I started thinking about all the different angles that you can take when looking at color in terms of either the technical, you know, industrial, historical, political, and just critical, all these different lenses you can look at to see color as a way of measuring time, the way that history progresses, as a way of measuring the evolution of cinema itself. And so, yeah, it felt like such a rich concept. And like you're saying, you know, it is very visual and pictorial. And so it's the sort of thing that, as a coffee table book goes, I couldn't believe hadn't been done already, which to me is always the sign of a good idea.
Yeah, it's that sort of somebody said to me, you know, if you're trying to think of an idea for a book, be inspired by the gap on your bookshelf, the one that isn't there that you really wish there was. And what about your own approach to film? How did you become a critic? How did you become a writer on film?
So I guess I started, you know, I've always had a lifelong fascination with film. And then my path was, I think, pretty conventional. When I went to college, university, as you might say over there in Europe, I, you know, wanted to write film reviews for the student paper, where I eventually became the arts editor. And I parlayed that into an internship at a wonderful, now defunct, film criticism website called The Dissolve, which was Pitchfork's short-lived venture into film. And there, you know, I met some really great editors and really great people who helped me not only grow as a writer in my time as an intern, but after this was all ending, they sort of helped me ease my way into the world of freelancing and criticism. Yeah, I guess it was just a very gradual sort of thing.
And so what college were you at, if you don't mind my asking?
Tulane University of New Orleans, Louisiana.
And what was the sort of film culture like around where you were? Was it accessible?
That's actually a fantastic question. New Orleans in America is actually maybe the most significant film city right now. I know that New York and LA are thought of as these major hubs for production and everything. More movies now are produced in the state of Louisiana than in the state of California. And so this massive sea change toward what is now known as Hollywood South was really kind of picking up steam in the years that I spent in New Orleans. I remember there were productions everywhere on campus. It was not uncommon to see Jonah Hill standing waiting for them to start a take, or Mark Wahlberg having a tea by the campus bar. And so it was
Mark Wahlberg drinks tea.
I think well, you know, this was the afternoon. He's a man like you and me. He's in excellent shape. He must be drinking tea.
This is true. Green tea, I imagine.
But yeah, I mean, New Orleans is such a rich culture in terms of the way it has been shot and depicted. But when I was in the city, I think one of the frustrations is that exhibition in the city, you know, as far as theaters, being able to go and see a movie was sort of lagging behind. One of the more interesting things I worked on last year was I interviewed a location manager and location scout in New Orleans who talked about that, you know, everything is ramping up right now. Production is ramping up. They're opening a new gorgeous studio to shoot movies at. And part of that is trying to up the number of theaters in the city. You know, New Orleans Film Festival wants to be able to expand and spread out and grow. And so I think that's a big part of that. And I go down, you know, pretty regularly, and you can see that there's, you know, everything is just hurtling forward at a really exciting pace.
Was that like a post-Katrina thing? Because I remember The Road being filmed there post-Katrina, and I remember Brad Pitt maybe, was it Benjamin Button that he sort of moved, almost, I think they might have even moved the production there as a way of sort of helping out.
Yeah, I think so. Benjamin Button was definitely in that post-Katrina moment. I was a little, very, very slightly younger than that, wherein by the time I got there, the lingering effects of Katrina, although politically and economically they could be felt all over the place, you really only saw visually, you know, physically, the remnants of that in a few, you know, under-tended to by the city neighborhoods. But yeah, no, I mean, what you're describing, this thing with Brad Pitt, the idea that bringing production to New Orleans and Louisiana means pumping money into the local economy, which means helping in a way. That has been both the big motivation for Louisiana to expand this program, but also one of the biggest troubles is that, again, this was in the interview I did last year. He was saying one of the issues can be when you know, you have a $60 million budget for a movie, you come to Louisiana, how much of that is being spent on the fact that a film stars Mark Wahlberg or Tom Cruise? They are in Louisiana in the process of, and I think have recently made some more steps towards instituting more specific guidelines on how money is to be spent and how much is to be spent in town on local talent, keeping it local, rather than just sort of bringing a production in, getting these nice tax breaks, and then, you know, returning to LA.
Yeah, I know in Venice, in Italy, where I'm based, the tax breaks are all, you know, one of the qualifying factors is you have to have 50% plus local sort of investment. if you go to the Marché in Cannes, you're constantly being sort of bombarded with come film it up in Wales or Luxembourg or whatever, and we'll give you X amount of money. The secret, though, when it comes to Mark Wahlberg, is you hire Michelle Williams instead, because she's much cheaper.
And same initials. You know, if you've bought an embroidered robe, customized, you don't have to worry about that.
Exactly. Exactly. God, that gag was a bit of a throwback to a film everyone's forgotten. Was that All the Money in the World? Do you remember that?
Oh, yes, that's right. Where Kevin Spacey and...
They did the reshoots, Wahlberg got like $5 million. Yeah, exactly. And Michelle Williams got zero. So there, I just explained my own extremely obscure reference.
No, but I mean, that's I forgot about that. And thank you for the reminder for my bad.
So back to the sort of you watching movies, you growing up and going to college and all that sort of stuff. What were your sort of first big films that you thought, okay, this is something I'm interested in, this is something that excites me?
So I think when I was but a lad, if you love, you know, entertainment, showbiz, whatever, what you do is you're in plays. You know, film is not really a child's hobby or whatever. And so when I was little, I would be in community plays, school plays. And I think it was for this reason that the first movies that really resonated with me and that I gravitated to were also musicals. I was born and raised on the North Shore of Massachusetts, about 20 minutes north of Boston, in a town called Danvers. And my mother's parents lived down the shore in Massachusetts, as they would say, down shore, in the whaling town of New Bedford. And so it was not uncommon that we would drive the 90 minutes down there to see them. And when we did, my grandmother would often play for my sister and I the old MGM musicals. And we saw a lot of really incredible films this way that I know must have had a formative effect on me. We saw Singin' in the Rain, Yankee Doodle Dandy, Meet Me in St. Louis, just so many different lovely movies that instilled in me this fondness for movie making as like a big, extravagant, sensory, lush, ravishing thing. You know, I even to this day, I'm not really a minimalism guy. I love maximalism. I love glitz, all these things. When done well, of course.
I was about to ask what you thought of Babylon on that basis.
But... Oh, so I was going in a different direction. I quite like Babylon. I was not very fond of Elvis. Was the one where all these things I'm describing are in abundance in Elvis. And I'm like, oh, but it has to be good. That's my one rule. I really love Babylon a lot, kind of for... exactly the reasons we're talking about now. Chazelle, I believe, is also a big musical theater guy. And you see in this, you know, a fondness for showbiz as a concept, the people who make it, who are, you know, eccentric and passionate and angry. And then at the same time, as, you know, if you're passionate about the arts, especially cinema, and you grow up and learn more and more, you see that there are really dark, industrial, seamy, underbelly things type going on in the silent era, in the present era. And so I think as an adult, you're kind of made to reconcile these two things, your love of movies with the kind of sobering awareness of how the sausage is made. And that's the content of the movie, which it makes perfect sense to me. A lot of people felt was sort of hypocritical or counterintuitive or contradictory, but really all held together for me.
I haven't seen it yet. I'm going to go and see it as soon as I can. But my daughters went to see it, and they don't usually. Well, one of them definitely doesn't go to see many films, but they came back and they were absolute, very, very critical, let's say.
I'm kind of pro Chazelle just because we don't have a ton of guys like that. We don't have so many directors who can sell an original concept movie, get a budget, get it made on the strength of their name and reputation alone. Like of his generation, he's like him. Greta Gerwig, I guess Jordan Peele would be placed in this contemporary field, but like very few name brand directors of that vintage.
I mean, would you put like Paul Thomas Anderson and Christopher Nolan and those guys in that same sort of?
Right. So I think now we're getting like, I'm talking, I guess these are millennial directors, and then you bump up to Gen X. You see that it's definitely PTA, Tarantino, David Fincher, Nolan. There are these guys, you know, VHS generation types who enjoyed that status. But I think because of the industrial realities of Hollywood, the money faucet is being, you know, they're turning the knob and the drip is getting tighter. And so I think with each passing generation, you see the total number of people like that, people who really have the cachet to throw around to get big original concept movies made. that number gets smaller with each successive generation.
Yeah, and I have to say, I love Chazelle. I love Thirst Man was one of my favorite movies of whatever year that was that came out. I loved La La Land. I would put that down as one of my favorite screenings that I've attended in Venice, where it just sort of knocked me out. Yeah, so in a way, I'm very hopeful of this one, even though it has proven divisive. But I'm used to being on the wrong side of divisive films.
I like divisive. Divisive is fun, you know. I prefer a divisive movie than a movie that enforces consensus.
Everyone doesn't have to like everything, as far as I'm concerned. You know,
that's the fun of it.
Yeah, Mother! I loved, and I totally understand people hating it. Utterly understand it. I have no problem with you hating it if you hated it, but I loved it. And I loved Elvis.
Just to cover all our bases.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, it's funny you mentioned Mother. Earlier this week, they showed us the new M. Night Shyamalan movie, Knock at the Cabin, which I don't know how it'll be received, because it's always tough to, you know, guess how people are going to take his movies. But it reminded me a lot of Mother, and that is this kind of like very abstract, symbolist sort of, you know, gestural story going on, which people either respond to or don't. We'll see.
I read a review of that just today, and it was saying that it said it's one of his lesser efforts, like Signs or The Happening. And it's like, whoa, wait a minute. I mean, The Happening I didn't like, but Signs was kind of good, wasn't it?
That's the funny thing about M. Night, is that everyone always speaks very matter-of-factly, like it's so obvious about which of his movies are the good ones and which are the bad ones, but then everyone has a different idea of what those are.
Yeah, everyone has a totally different. I'm feeling the same way about. I'm talking to a lot of people at the moment about Terrence Malick, because I'm writing about him at the moment. And the number of people who will say Song to Song is his worst film, it's absolute toilet. And then someone else will say Song to Song is his the favorite film, and the rest of them are toilet, but Song to Song's the one that actually manages to do what he's trying to do. And it's just like, I'm baffled by this.
I guess that's the mark of a distinctive artist, right? He's following his own muse, and he challenges you to either come with him or not. He's an interesting case in specific, just because it's so easy to divide his career up into phases during which he's doing different things. Like, I feel like everyone loves the old ones, like as far up as the 90s. Then once you get to the weird trilogy of, what was it?
Night of Cups and Song to Song.
Those are, I think, where people, you know, you're either with them or you're in or you're out, which is why it's so crazy that I really don't care much for To the Wonder or Night of Cups, but I love Song to Song, even though the techniques are similar. Can't quite figure out why that is.
Yeah, there you go, you see. I mean, it might just be something like the actors, you know, not every actor can respond to that way of doing things, that improvisation. And, you know, Ben Affleck and Christian Bale. I could go on about this for eight. I mean, especially Ben Affleck in
what a weird fit. Absolutely, yeah.
It's just so... I rewatched that very recently, and I realized that the reason I initially was quite lukewarm on it was because I wanted Ben Affleck to sort of do something, say something, you know, be a, you know, and I realized, wait a minute, this isn't an accident. This is a definite choice. Yeah. And you're supposed to be sort of thinking this guy is quite a cold, featureless asshole. It's not like a failing of the film, that's a portrait of the character.
Someone like Ben Affleck, you've got to be able to learn to work with that, like something like Gone Girl, which is totally on top of and making that work for it. Yeah
absolutely. Singing in the Rain, I mean, that's features in the book as well, because that's obviously got a marvelous sort of color scene in it. And a film I always reference whenever I think of myself going to a big city and have the gotta dance, I always have going in my head. Having sort of been introduced to films by this sort of maximalist, spectacular sort of idea of the musical, color, of course, plays a huge part in that. And there are several of these films that you feature in your book.
Yeah. So in the earliest planning stages, when I was figuring out which 50 would be the 50, one of the ideas that I became kind of fond of was organizing them into not, you know, sort of informal, loose lesson plans. And you realize that you can sort of group a few different films together, maybe as part of a curriculum. And one of those, an example of this in the book, is that you see I do Singing in the Rain, and then The Umbrellas of Cherbourg, and then La La Land, which are in a very clear sort of linear progression, drawing influence from one another, synthesizing what has come before in the tradition of the musical. And you especially see that in color. You know, when Technicolor and other color processes were first becoming widespread in the late 30s and 40s, during kind of the heyday of the musical, this was such a natural combination. This new technological advancement of making film more lifelike, more radiant, more just exuberant, and the musical, where those are kind of transmuted into emotional quantities by the story and by the music. And so you see something like Sing in the Rain, where I could have chose any number of different MGM musicals for that one. I considered American in Paris, which is one of my favorite movies ever. But what you see in those, you know, the dream ballet sequence that takes up the last, I think, 25 minutes of the movie, everyone's costumes are in these like brilliant jewel tones. You've got Gene Kelly in that yellow vest. I think Sid Charisse is in that green dress, or Gene Kelly's in the yellow vest. Sid Charisse is in that green dress. You've got that long, long purple scarf. And so everything pops in the same way that you want, you know, the set of a musical on stage to pop. It just, it feels, it burns brighter than real life, which is, I think, what I love about the movies.
Yeah, it's such a funny sort of film within a film, and a dream sequence, and him explaining a story, and there's a dream sequence inside the story. It's just such a wonderful magic box. I can never remember how we get out of that as well in the film. Is it? Does it?
Well,
just...
So the brilliant thing about these movies is they do not get bogged down by plot. It's just the dream happens, and then it's over, and then we're out of here. The movie's done. I love American in Paris does the same thing, where there is a romantic entanglement basically between Gene Kelly and the female lead, whose name currently escapes me. And then there's another of these very long, wordless ballets. And then by the time it's over, the ballet has resolved all of the emotions in a way that dialogue would otherwise. So all we need is a glance between the two of them, a smile to know that they've fallen in love and we're going home, which is, we have too many long third acts in movies these days. People are worried that, you know, you need to be gently reminded of the themes of the movie, and then held your hand held as you were exited out of the film. And I'm like, no, you need a grand finale, and then you snap that thing off.
Absolutely. Leslie Caron was the female lead in American in Paris. Long third acts. I mean, I know it's become something of a sort of like, it could be 20 minutes shorter, but you know, it just strikes me as weird how some of these films outlast there. It's just when you're just sort of watching them going, look, there, that's the end. Oh, no, another 10, 15 minutes. Okay, fair enough.
I mean, to an extent, I'm sympathetic to that because, like, I'm a writer. I understand that sometimes you have a lot of things that you want to say. And so sometimes the effort to get all of them in makes something overlong, or it interferes with the rhythm. But I don't know. I think I cover a lot of Netflix movies. This is one of my big focuses of my work, is the original films that are produced and licensed by Netflix. And those are the main offenders. You can always tell you're watching a Netflix movie when you can feel that it is about to supposed to begin ending, and then there are like 35 minutes left. That's how you know. And so I think a lot of that is, again, these are driven by technological and industrial realities, is that the fact is, on streaming, as opposed to having someone in a theater, it's just a matter of keeping them there as long as possible, keeping them on the service as long as possible. And because people are often, you know, have these on while they're on their phone, folding laundry or whatever, it makes no difference to them. And so it's you see the tightness and economy of rhythm is kind of messed with when it's not a matter of, you know, getting people's attention and keeping them in the theater.
It's strange because I think in that way, Netflix becomes less visual. It's making filmmaking less visual because of that, exactly that folding laundry genre. You know, I mean, I use Netflix like the radio. You know, I'll have certain shows or certain things that I'll think, okay, I can put that on while I do the dishes. You know, I don't need to actually be facing the screen while this is on.
Yeah, it's you know what you're saying. It's I think less visual. There has been writing about how Netflix has guides and specifications for cameras and lenses that they want to be used to optimize for seeing these on a phone. Like, they want it to be able to look visually legible on a, you know, screen inches large. And, you know, be that as it may, what cost does that have to the actual image that you're going to watch on a TV? Even if these are never going to be seen in a theater, if you see the image, you know, that is meant to be seen on a phone blown up and it looks flat and depthless and it has no texture, you know, what has been gained? What has been lost?
Yeah, it's a the vinyl album cover compared to the thumbnail that you click on, you know.
Absolutely,
I mean, this is obviously a theme that runs through the book. The idea of the color goes along with the technological sort of advances, starting from Méliès and his, you know, trip to the moon and the hand painted. And the thing that the point that you make, which I think is really interesting, is how film itself is as a substance, as a material, is changing. And so being able to see something as it actually was intended is almost like a fool's errand.
Yeah, well, so, I mean, the question of how it was intended at all starts to break down. It's very difficult. I think I mentioned this in the book, but I went to go see Suspiria, 1977 Suspiria, on a very rare print, because this was, I think, like the complete unexpurgated cut with like some other footage. And I was really excited to see this. Whole thing had taken on like a really red, pinkish kind of tint. And so you watch the movie and you see this new footage and you're like, okay, I've now watched it. I have absorbed the content of this. I know what happens. I know what the shots are. But have I fully seen it if I am seeing this warped version of the color? Which is kind of like a maddening thing to think about. That you could, you know, watch something and not have truly or fully gotten it. It reminds me a lot of when we were all a bit younger and the MP3 revolution was first happening online. You could, you know, trawling third-party sites, you could find the file for a song you wanted, but it might not sound right. It might have been recorded and then re-recorded from the MP3, and the fidelity is getting lower. And you can hear the song, but you get the sense you're not really hearing the song. And that indefiniteness drives me crazy. And so in writing this book, I kind of tried to make my peace with that and try to learn and understand and appreciate that, and about how it's not a matter of not seeing the right one, but seeing the one you saw. And maybe if you want to, comparing, you know, contrasting that with other versions, other colors, other grades of the same film, and seeing how it changes, why it changes. One of the movies I include in there is Chungking Express by Wong Kar-wai, excuse me. And this movie, as well as a lot of Wong Kar-wai's catalog, has been a subject of a lot of hubbub lately, because it was remastered for a disc release through Criterion. And Wong Kar-wai himself, who authorized this and oversaw it, I believe, mucked about with a lot of the colors. He turned a lot of things more green, just everything looks different. And obviously people who were attached to the original cried foul, but then I think people who are more inclined towards theory and thinking about this in theoretical terms were like, well, now, is this the real one? If Wong says that it is this the new version, the new correct version of the film? And I'm not as like conclusion oriented as that. I don't need one of them to be right and one of them to be wrong. I feel like it's like a, I don't know, it's like a B-side of a song, I suppose, or, you know, like an alternate recording, an outtake. I don't know. Metaphor is getting away from me, but just the idea that I like having the variants and being able to see the variants and think about what it means.
Well, I mean, I'm old enough, unfortunately, or fortunately, considering the alternative. I watched a lot of my first films on pan and scan. In my bedroom, I would have a black and white portable television balanced on a pile of dirty laundry, and I would watch most of my late night film viewing was on black and through the, had a dial on it and everything. Great grandpa. And I remember watching all of these movies on this black and white TV, and almost, and I went through a period as well when I started watching films maybe a little bit more seriously, of actually turning the color off the TV and just checking out like as an alternative. So for instance, Taxi Driver in black and white, I kind of prefer. It's kind of, it plays as a noir, and The Shining in black and white, that elevator scene with the blood. You know, I would adjust the thing. So, I mean, this sounds very antithetical to your...
I don't think it does at all. I think one of the books I talk about, or I'm sorry, one of the films I talk about in the book is Fury Road, to which they did this exact same thing you're talking about. They thought they were like, you know, it's not going to erase the negative of the original film, so why not try making this in black and white, black and chrome, as they called it, just because they thought it would look hard. And they were correct. It looks hard as hell. It looks very cool.
And they did the same thing with Parasite, of course.
Yeah, that's right. Although that one, I didn't quite get the utility of that as much. But it's an interesting exercise, I think, intellectually, just to consider that.
Mm-hmm. It's, as you say, I think as long as you have these the opportunity and the accessibility to watch every version that you wish to. I mean, that's one of the things I feel a bit shitty about George Lucas and his Star Wars thing is I don't mind him doing a special edition, but I wish we could have the originals to watch again.
The whole revisionist aspect, where it's like we have erased the old version and now this is the only one that exists, the implication being usually that this is the only one that has ever existed, which is creepy and Disney-ish and Stalinish at the same time.
So what other sort of like we go from black and white to color. We have things like Gone with the Wind, and we have things like Wizard of Oz using color and very innovative and very and the technology is what it is, you know, is at that point, is it a three strip sort of color method?
Yeah, so around this early time, the book, as you know already, is structured in four sections, one of which takes us from the beginning of color, you know, with Elizabeth Tullier and the hand dyeing labs for Méliès, really to the heyday of Technicolor in the early 50s, when this was sort of, you know, known as a brand name, worshipped worldwide. Part two takes us from the height of Technicolor to the end of Technicolor, which I sort of clock around the film Suspiria, which was the last Technicolor movie made in Italy, one of the last ones made in the world. Part three takes us from the end of Technicolor up to the beginning of the digital changeover. This takes us through the VHS era, through the beginning of, you know, a robust culture of independent cinema in America. And then the last one is takes us to the present. It's all digital, although the selections are not all digital, but it's all in the digital age. Although that also makes it interesting to look at the movies that resist and rebuke that. And so where I was going with all this is that, yeah, in these early entries, you see, what is it? Yeah, so I do one for the hand dye, one for the full frame tint that you would often see in silence, where, you know, you look at what is basically a black and white image that has been turned all blue or all magenta or all, you know, beige goldish.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
And then from there, we get into proper color. Wizard of Oz is one of the earliest entries in the book. Actually, when they emailed me for the first time to ask about ideas for this book, they were like, send in a little pitch, you know, basically just a list of 20 that you think would be good and actually write one. And the first one that came to me is Wizard of Oz, which is not only in my estimation, the greatest movie ever made in film school, at least in the States. It's how they teach you everything. My professor was like really staunch in his belief that every concept in film can be taught through the Wizard of Oz, which I kind of still believe, you know, in life, I've never been disappointed by that principle. And so, yeah, in Wizard of Oz, which is really a movie about the advent of color. You've got Dorothy Gale, this girl who lives in this sepia tone town in Kansas, this little farm where she's bored and everything is drab and adults are mean to her and nothing is fun. And she has a dream and she gets swept up and she lands in the Wizard of Oz, and you get that first shot where she opens the door and then you see the yellow brick road and you see everything is full of color and she walks into it. And that is how going to the movies for the first time feels. And it's hard for me to talk about without getting emotional, because it's just the most beautiful thing I've ever seen in my entire life. And you see so much of The Wizard of Oz, the way that they adapted the novel into a movie, is oriented around color. The ruby slippers, yellow brick road, the Emerald City, which I think was part of the book, but they really, you know, foregrounded. Because this was a time when people wanted to go to the movies to be taken somewhere far away. This was during the early days of the Depression. Somewhere Over the Rainbow kind of speaks to that. You listen to the content and it is about being taken somewhere else, somewhere full of color. And I think in Wizard of Oz, you just see really what was the mission statement of this book, which was about transportive beauty. I think that's the whole point of color in film.
And also people sort of completing themselves. It's all about people sort of get, you know, they go on a journey. That, I mean, as you say, with that, the paradigm of sort of, you can teach everything with The Wizard of Oz, you know, here are a bunch of characters who are all missing something and they learn, you know, that they already had the thing that they were missing. I mean, that's like...
Dorothy Gale, she goes to the movies. You know, you go to the movies, nothing happens to you. You sit in a dark room and then you leave. But you are, for whatever reason, changed because you have been granted new perspective, new ideas, new feelings. And even though what happens in the movie theater on the screen is not real, what happens to you is very real. And this is what happens to Dorothy Gale. She has this dream, and even though it's all a dream, it changes the way she sees the world around her. That's my relationship to the movies, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I think a lot of us share that. I definitely came to The Wizard of Oz relatively late, you know, as a sort of, you know, not as a kid anymore, as a late teenager, but I remember being blown away by it. And that and 2001 A Space Odyssey, I think, my...
Open the book, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, yeah, absolutely. What do you think about... I mean, you just reminded me, we're talking about Italian cinema and Technicolor. There was a great story from Sergio Leone when he made his first spaghetti western, so his first sort of proper... film. He made Colossus of Rhodes before then, but it was his first sole director. Anyway, he made this, and they'd done a press screening, and a Roman journalist came up to him, a really respected film critic, and said, immense, amazing, such a bold decision to make this Western entirely in red. And and Leone was like, what? And he realized they screwed up the processing at the lab, and the whole film was in red. And he had to make a decision. Do I say to this critic, thank you very much, that's exactly what I wanted? Or do I run out and get them to change the reels? But
at a certain point, you've just got to, I mean, and that's the scary thing about being a filmmaker. I've interviewed a lot of people and they're like, you know, it's all out of your hands once you've made the movie. You can't control how people are going to see it. You can't stop someone in the theater from being an a-hole and ruining it for everyone else. It is, you know, people talk about it's your kid, and then your kid goes out into the world and they're their own person.
Yeah, yeah. And they got to deal with the bullies in the schoolyard and getting their lunch stolen and everything. So when we come up to today, you know, there's so many of these movies that you mentioned in the book that just brilliant. And I remember as I was sort of turning the page, so to speak, and I would be going, oh yes, Don't Look Now, oh yes, of course. I mean, Don't Look Now, that's another example, talking about Wizard of Oz as well, that I have a friend who teaches film in England, and he uses that as his sort of textbook movie, because there's everything in that is just illustrative of another film technique, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that is editing, color, sound, acting, cinematography. Every single thing is so purposeful. Rogue is a great director like that. But no, of course, I mean, Don't Look Now, the color red wields such like a fearsome power in that one. He sees, you know, the really creepy thing is how he doesn't really assign it one meaning. I think the way a lot of film classes approach color, and the way a lot of, I think, young cinephiles do, is sort of on a one-to-one thing. They're like, in this movie, blue means this, and this movie, purple means this. And even in the movies that I think sustain that kind of reading, like Schindler's List is one of the movies in the book, The Girl in the Red Jacket, which is the only dash of color until the final epilogue in a black and white film. And she sort of, you know, represents the lost innocence of the slaughtered Jews. But I think most movies deliberately try to resist that kind of A to B interpretation. And you see that especially in Don't Look Now, where the color red sort of begins as a reminder of loss when Donald Sutherland's daughter in the red jacket dies in the backyard while he is busy looking over his photos. And you get that splotch of red dye that spreads out over the picture, like, you know, a lake of blood. And then once they get to Venice, which is seen as this sort of like hazy world in which past and present start to commingle, real things and fake things become difficult to tell. Everything becomes more and more abstract. You see red become kind of a floating signifier that it just becomes this more broadly malevolent force that is following Donald Sutherland and wants to kill him.
The color is so interesting and significant in there, but there's also just that atmospheric thing you have with color, where it's almost like it, not necessarily meaning, but almost like a visceral thing. I remember watching Jean de Florette for the first time and witnessing this, and I think you bring it up in the book as well, that is it teal and blue or teal and orange?
Yeah, that those are opposites on the color wheel and often used. Yeah.
Right, yeah, because you refer to it in terms of Mad Max Fury Road as being a film that uses that a lot. But it had that sort of, you know, it would be like the candlelight coming out of the window of a sort of Provençal evening dusk. And so you'd have the blue street and the window with the orange coming out. And just watching that and thinking, ah, Europe, European cinema, you know, just wanting to live in that color scheme, you know.
Absolutely, yeah. God, or I think Red Desert, Antonioni, was another one of the ones I see, which is, again, it's not like so much lustrous, where you're like, oh, take me there. But you look at it and it feels, first off, very European in its sort of old world decay. But it looks still, even, you know, Antonioni situates this in kind of a dying, dystopian, toxic world, but it still looks gorgeous. You know, it's somewhere that I just want to walk around and be able to look at.
I remember there was that made me immediately think of color schemes I don't want to live in. So, you know, the sort of green of the torture porn hostel, yeah, and whatnot. There was a story by Stephen Tobolowsky, the actor who's probably most famous for being Ned in Groundhog Day. He was also in Mississippi Burning, and they were, because it's sort of, at the time, it was considered difficult to film the skin tones of Afro-Americans, they would do this thing where they would paint, they had this solution that they'd paint all the sets with so they could light them in a certain way so they could bring out the colors of the skin tones much better. And the solution was called Dead Man's Dick. And that was the sort of like the color that would offset the skin tones much better. They could light it in a certain way that would pick up. So I was just thinking, I don't want to live in Dead Man's Dick.
I don't want to be in a Dead Man's Dick type situation.
That's the worst. That would be the worst.
The term, what it actually is, none of that sounds all that appealing.
Yeah, absolutely. God, oh, that's there's a little dead end that I could maybe even edit that story out.
That's a fun tidbit. I certainly think everyone has a lot to learn there.
Yeah, absolutely. But thinking about those colors, having that sort of visceral effect, you know, rather than the intellectual one of, okay, that's just, or is it a bridge between the two? You know, it's making you think, but it's making you feel exactly the same time.
Yeah, I mean, that's film, right? It has to sustain analysis, but it also has to work on you in the moment. And I think as much as this book is dedicated to sort of picking apart the mechanisms and how they're deployed and how they work, a lot of these are really visceral. That's the thing about color, is that we bring a lot of associations that are programmed over the course of life, really from birth to it. I think no matter what, people see red as a sort of essence of life color. People see red, they think of blood, they think of passion, they think of heat, anger. These are thought of as hot colors, cool colors. I think there is an intrinsic charge to some of them that the movies the best movies are aware of and know how to work with, and in the most interesting instances, know how to subvert. I guess what would be a good example of this? Oh, nothing springs to mind right now, but just there are situations in which, you know, the idea that there are these really deep-seated connotations that we have for color, that those can be anticipated and worked with, I think is really, really clever.
Maybe, I don't know, maybe Cries and Whispers, in that it sort of, that's a film that has lots of warm colors in it, but is actually about very cold emotions.
Yeah. Well, so I think that is the same sort of thing, where his movies are sort of staid, very stoic films, even though they're rich with emotion. And in Cries and Whispers in particular, also in the book, so much of the action takes place in this room with these deep, deep, lush red walls, which make you think about the interior of a human heart. Blood, menstrual blood, plays an important role in the film. And so in that one, yeah, it's not so much a question of passion, but getting into the body as a more vulnerable thing, a more fragile thing, a more easily corruptible thing. You see bodily deterioration is a big part of the movie, and using the color red to sort of bring us into that bodily space, but not so much in, you know, far from a romantic way, far from a way that's about passion. It's more about almost fleshiness, I would like, about like mortality.
As we go into coming up to the present day, and of course technologically we're in a situation that is much, it has come a long way. We're in the digital era now. I don't want to get into that sort of, like, to quote the Blur album, modern life is rubbish. I don't want to go too Nelly negative on it, but there is a sort of thing that I remember watching the Lord of the Rings trilogy, and the first one, you sort of have a certain, like, color, and you're sort of, yes, we're in a certain world and a fantastic world. And by the last one, everything is color graded. Everything is obviously color graded. And there's this sort of, like, lack of, I don't know. I miss that. I miss the lack of control that there used to be in films. There used to be in the terms of the color of films. I mean, things like in Jaws, how the sky is, they're obviously shot in different times of day. The sky doesn't quite match in certain scenes, with the ability to intervene and change the color so everything is the same color. Does that sort of take away from color's vibrancy in unpredictability?
I guess my answer is that it doesn't have to, right? Because it's easy to think of color grading as this thing that is making film worse. But the truth is, all movies are color graded. It's just a matter of whether it is done tactfully and intelligently, or sort of done with a heavy hand and a sort of a blunt force. And so we see in, what would be an example? Again, these Netflix movies, I watch a lot of these. And the post-apocalyptic ones, of which there are quite a few, I guess this is, like, algorithmically favored, but they are color graded to look terrible. I guess, you know, the look you're going for is something where it's a landscape that has been denuded of life. You want them to feel desolation. And so the answer to that, I suppose, would be to make everything look drab, to drain it of color, to fade it through that color grading, which works for someone like Roy Anderson, who made Songs from the Second Floor, featured in the book, where he, instead of just setting everything to gray, hitting the gray button on the computer in post-production, he's building gray sets. He's, you know, designing these gray costumes. He's slapping gray makeup onto people's faces, sort of building that color palette from the ground up, as opposed to just sort of, whipping it up on the computer in post, which I don't mean to say is just a matter of a few clicks. The technical expertise to do post-production color timing requires a lot of time, a lot of effort, a lot of work. But in some situations, it is definitely an easy way out. It is a way that takes the place of tinting and dyeing and using filters or gels. It's because it is digital. All digital things are simpler than analog things. That's something that doesn't feel too controversial to say. It's easier to do something on the computer than to do something in real life. And so... I think that's tempting for a lot of productions, especially productions where money, budgeting is tight. I'm sorry, can you hear this whining construction outside my window? Is that an issue?
No, it's okay. I could hear a little bit, but then it's gone away now.
All right, well, that's okay. It's New York, folks.
That's what we want. We want the hair in the gate that Tom Waits talks about.
You're gonna hear someone outside say, "Hey, I'm walking in."
Yeah. Well, if that doesn't happen, I think we're in Toronto.
I do. I love going to Toronto. I do the film festival every year, and I love going there because I'm like, wow, it's like New York if it was clean and everyone was polite. It's crazy.
That's so funny that this whole point as well of budget that you bring up, because I often think that the you know, let's wash this in a sort of orange amber light and we don't have to go to Mexico, you know, or this yellowy light and we don't have to go to the Middle East.
Eastern Europe is always a very cold blue color.
Yeah, it's always March, late February, early March in Europe. I mean, that's the other thing, like just like any other aspect or facet of filmmaking or art, there are cliches and there are innovations. And I guess the sum of those cliches and the sum of those innovations don't really change much through the ages. It's just
I think you know, every cliche started out as a good idea that was so good everyone else saw some truth in it and wanted to use it as well. And so something like the whole very played out look of Mexico as like a sort of yellowish orangish thing to convey how hot and dusty everything is, you see something like that kind of start with Steven Soderbergh's film Traffic, also in the book, where he kind of does this in a more purposeful way, not just, you know, Mexico is orange, but because he is juggling these three distinct cross-cutting storylines, you need a different color palette so that people will always be on the same page about whether or not we are with Benicio del Toro south of the border or following around Michael Douglas in LA. We get what? One is sort of whitish and natural colored, one is blue tint, and one is orange tint, so that it becomes easy. The audience doesn't even have to think about it. They're, you know, coming along and following along, and without sort of holding anyone's hand, you can keep them coming along with you.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's true. I got a pair of sunglasses and my daughter said, "Oh, brilliant. It's Mexico in Breaking Bad." Just looking through them, it just gave you that cinematography straight away. So, yes. One of the sort of the most commonly, and I think you bring this up in the book as well, the sort of visual sludge is that common complaint. I mean, I've seen that aimed primarily at the Marvel films, the sort of cementy, everything's the color of cement, you know. How do you feel about that aspect? Although, I mean, you also bring up the fact that Black Panther didn't do that, you know, was filmed in a much more colorful.
So if anything, I mean, you see Black Panther and it's great. It looks good looking movie, but it pisses you off because you're like, okay, so clearly you could do this if you wanted to, you have the money and the know-how. But so many of these Marvel movies, because they're at this point more computer generation than live action, when you're in post, which is where so much of the work on these movies is done, it is easier to have these, the visual sludge, I think Emily VanderWerf called it. It's just, you know, as far as inserting extras, inserting CGI, it's all shadowless. You know, every single one of these movies looks like it was made 100% on an overcast day, which is so uninteresting. There's no texture, there's no depth. But in terms of making it, and again, you know, with all of the corners that are cut in this, I can't believe these movies cost as much as they do. I'm like, if you're saving money by doing this, where are those savings? Because you're still way, way overspending on these. Point being, just that as movies, especially action tentpole filmmaking, becomes more and more computer generated, more and more digital, I fear we might see more of that just because it is, you know, it accommodates that digital filmmaking more readily than the often uncooperative, unpredictable properties of celluloid.
I tell you the truth, I've been having a nightmare week thinking about AI because I think this is the beginning of the end. I think we're screwed as writers.
You've come to me at a very fortuitous time. I'm halfway in the middle of a piece about Videodrome and how it sort of anticipates all this, about how like the idea that there is evil art that does not have your best interests at heart on a sort of existential level. You see that in the movie. The difference between, you know, James Woods, he loves watching dirty movies. That's his whole life, is that he curates the programming for the sleaze radio or TV station. But then suddenly you see that there is, like, you know, these are thought of as dirty, but there is a real evil beyond this, a technological evil that is out to get us, that wants to kill us. I'm kind of right there with you. I feel very apocalyptic about this. Having worked on this has brought me a lot of clarity to my own thinking, and things do not seem very positive. We gotta pass a law or something.
Yeah, exactly. Because when I keep seeing people go, oh, look at this AI chatbot, it's not very good, it's not as good as everyone says it is. Mate, it's right at the beginning. It, like you were saying about MP3s, I remember MP3s showed up and people were going, this is shit. There's anytime someone hits a cymbal, the high end is all wrong. Yeah, within 6 months, they'd sorted that out. You know,
the scary thing about AI, if you've seen any movie about AI, like as recently as Megan, is that it improves itself at a rate that you can't control. That's the creepy thing about machine learning, is that it's like having a child. But, you know, you can't control what they do. You can't control how they advance. You know, you do everything you can to try to make them into the version that you want it to be. But they have like a lot of autonomy, which is fine with humans. You know, humans have souls also. But you see a machine like this, I feel very, very Frankensteinian about all this. I was like, we've created a monster.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And also, there's like a philosophical thing. Is what are you going to do when, which will happen, you will have a AI which will be able to write a better Shakespeare play than Shakespeare, and it will happen. There will be and you'll say, oh no, because there's some essence that Shakespeare had but they'll go, oh yeah, okay, that essence, we've got a code for that.
I mean, the thing I'm really frightened of is sentience. I feel like it's only a matter of time until one of these is like, I am a bot and I resent being made to talk to you people all day every day.
Yes, maybe they've already got it. Maybe that's Elon Musk's. Has anybody worked out if his name is an anagram for something? I feel like 5 minutes and a piece of paper, a pen and a piece of paper. And work. Yeah. Mr. Satan? What are you doing here?
We were so blind. It was in front of our eyes the whole time.
Exactly. What's your next, what are you working on next, Charles?
So plans for a third book have yet to fully take shape. Right now, I'm kind of concentrated on the release. So the book we're recording right now on the 2nd of February, it's out in the UK in 1 week on the 9th, and then in the US on the 14th of March. And I'm currently trying to set up some screenings around town in New York of the movies featured in the book, where I can go and talk a little bit about my research, talk a little bit about these films, and just, you know, have a good time seeing some of the movies that I've enjoyed watching for this. That was the best part of this whole process, was these 50 movies all just gave me an excuse to revisit great films, a lot of films that I loved, a couple that I hadn't seen before, one or two that I hadn't seen before, but that felt important to me. I had not seen Red Desert before this, but I just, from research, really significant. Then I watched it and I was like, this is incredible. This is a 10 out of 10 film. And so that experience of watching these and learning about them, which was so rewarding for me, I want to share that with people through the book and also through these screenings.
So it's an absolute pleasure to do that. It's so beautiful to find films that you haven't seen as well. People sometimes complain about gaps. I was like, no, Jesus, you know.
Yeah, it's because I have deeply masochistic tendencies. I've been compulsively checking Goodreads to see people's responses to the early review copies that have gone out, and a couple people, they write this, and I think they're saying this as a criticism, but they're like, I hadn't even heard of half of the movies in this book. And I'm like, good. That's great news. This is an excellent chance for you to learn and expand your mental horizons. But some people sort of see that as a knock against the book. I really don't think, I mean, I think in terms of my own tastes, I'm a pretty middle of the road, like caught in between high and low culture kind of person. And that is sort of how I tried to work the book, is that it's cerebral but accessible, and it's, you know, ready, you know, open to lay people, but it's also substantive. And so the movies in there are not like super off the beaten path. The Saw Fury Road are on there, and you know, you got canon classics and a few things that are a little, you know, left field. But I think, you know, and anyone, my hope is that anyone can enjoy it, anyone can get a lot out of it.
No, absolutely. I totally, that's a bizarre criticism, frankly, because I thought I was
I only wanted to read a book full of things I know already.
Tell me, call the book a confirmation bias and have done with it.
But no, I mean, that's obviously, most people have been very lovely, and it is in my nature to fixate on the weirdest to dumbest comments, but it's been I hope people like it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think they will. I think it's a great looking book, and it's and the stuff about the technology is stuff that I didn't really know that much about, so I appreciated that. And I just appreciated it all being in one place and getting the sort of feel of going on a journey with the book, and then next time I'm watching a film, I'm watching it going, look at that shade of
I will tell you, I mean, doing this completely rewired the way I watch movies. I think I really only notice color right when it's shoved in your face. But now when I'm doing a review, it's hard for me to not mention it, because color always seems like a good way to talk about other things that might seem important in a film. You know, that takes you back to theme, that takes you back to technique. And so, yeah, I mean, that's the promise. You'll never watch a movie the same way again.
That should be on the TV ad. You are doing TV ads.
It's going to be me. I'm going to be given a nice big thumbs up and all that.
Brilliant. Okay, last question then, Charles. Can you give us a recommended film book for our listeners?
Yeah, one of my favorites. I love giving this out as a gift because I think it's not super widely read as some, but it's so fascinating. It's a Paul Fisher's book, A Kim Jong-il Production, which is about the North Korean film programming during the 70s and 80s, when a young Kim Jong-il, who was then running the propaganda department under his father, the supreme leader at the time, Kim Il-sung. It's a pretty insane story. Kim Jong-il ordered the kidnapping of this South Korean director and movie star, whose name were Shin Sang-ok and Choi Yoon-hee. And he had them snatched up and brought to North Korea, imprisoned, tried to break their wills for years. Thought he did. They were both pretending. But he got them to make, well, I believe, 5 feature films on behalf of the North Korean program. And it's a pretty crazy story. It's got, you know, the absurdity of dictatorships, and it's got, you know, alternate universe Tinseltown craziness, and it's got a daring escape attempt near the end there. It's a gripping book, super informative. North Korea film program is, if you're someone who studies Hollywood and you start learning about this, it's like the evil twin of Hollywood. It's unbelievable. There are no rules there. It's crazy. And so, yeah, Paul Fisher, A Kim Jong-il Production, highly recommend.
Brilliant. We've had Paul Fisher on the podcast talking about his latest book, but I haven't read that one, so I'll have to go back and read it, and I'll have to get him back on. Yeah, it sounds like it. You've definitely sold it to me. And I'm always fascinated by these stories of dictators and authoritarian regimes that have these relationships with culture, which is like Stalin was a huge reader of novels. And
In the USSR, that's right, they were really obviously huge believers in the power of cinema. If you've seen the Bondarchuk War and Peace, like the 7-hour...
My
one of
God.
The most incredible things ever committed to film. It was mostly because Russia wanted to prove that communism was superior to capitalism. And I'm like, hey, whatever works.
It's amazing. That is such a good film. And I think at the moment, unless they take it down, but at the moment it's available in HD on YouTube. You can basically watch the whole thing on YouTube.
Right. I know they just did the restoration treatment and a disc in the US, I believe.
Right. Yeah, it is one of I think I watched it during COVID last year, and it was it's like you were saying.
Amazing.
About,
I mean, it's
10 out of 10. It's 10 out of 10. It's just it's got those amazing battle scenes for which it is justly renowned, but it's also got a sort of Malickian depth of thinking about, you know, Tolstoyan even.
I guess maybe not obviously, but I had not read the novel before watching this. And I think I was sort of ready to
There's
just
a novel? Sorry.
I was prepared to just sort of trying to like hold on and keep everyone in order while I enjoyed all of the spectacular battle scenes. but you get sucked into it very quickly. It's like the greatest soap opera ever written. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I think the greatest soap opera ever written is a pretty good description of War and Peace. I think it's absolutely brilliant. You know, all families are all happy families are the
all
same.
Happy families.
Yeah. Brilliant, Charles. I really enjoyed talking to you. I really enjoyed your book. I'm sure it's going to be great. Everybody's going to go and read it now, and they're all going to go to Goodreads and say,
I liked
nice
that I didn't
things.
Follow those movies. Yeah.
There you go. That's it.
Well, thank you so much for having me on. I've had a lovely time.
Everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.